Are you looking to make a podcast? Well, if you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. First off, it's free. Nothing is better than free. Am I right? Anchor provides creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you, so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more services. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, which is very refreshing for very fresh, new podcasts looking to get their start. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Welcome back to the swamp, my friends. It's been a long time since we've read stories from the highways, but I've got enough stories sent in now that we can do another volume of these. If you have a story that you would like to share in a future video, whether it be a highway story or something else, be sure to submit it at swampdweller.net or the email you can find in the description down below. I'd love to share your story with everyone here in the swamp. It's stories like yours that help keep this channel going. Now, without further ado, let's get into these creepy highway stories sent in by viewers just like you. This is the one time I considered something paranormal happening to me. I work in a boomtown north in Alberta, and I live in Saskatchewan, so it's about a 6-hour drive for me. This happened towards the end of last spring. I was coming off my night shift and decided I'm going to sleep for a few hours, but ended up sleeping until 4 p.m. Everything was fine until it got really dark, just after 9 p.m. It was getting close to this one long curve and stretch on a road where I always felt uneasy every time I went through there, which I later found out I'm not the only one who has this feeling. I was in my car approaching this curve, and with no service, my story's cut out. It's quiet now, and my podcast is no longer playing. I see what looks like a very large buck in the ditch at the distance. So I start slowing down, I get about 100 meters to it, and I see it cross the road. I think, good, I'm not going to hit it. But when I got to the middle of the road, I yell, "Whoa!" Feeling the most intense chill in the back of my head and spine. It had no legs and head. It was just floating. It ran over the field and then faded into nothing. I realized I was in a bit of a panic. I put both my hands on the steering wheel and started breathing calmly. After doing this, I noticed my heart felt like it was beating out of my chest. I drove faster while trying to control myself. After the curve and on the stretch, I decided to play some music to calm myself down. I drove the last hour trying not to think about what had just happened. I remember two thoughts though. One, that I was just seeing things, but I wasn't sleep deprived or anything. And two, wishing I had a dash cam. I still travel home this route, but I avoid traveling through there at night, and now I have a dash cam. I know my story was short and probably not scary to most, but it is true. The name of this road is Lick Road in Cincinnati, Ohio. A group of my friends and I went to Lick Road while we were in high school. The story of this road is that a girl named Amy, no one knows if this is the actual name of the girl or not, but the story goes she was assaulted and killed at the end of the road. People get the name Amy from a sign that was sprayed on a sign in the reflective paint next to the road. So, the name Amy took off. Anywho, she supposedly haunts the road looking for help. Another thing for this road is, of course, it has the timid headlights. At 12 a.m, exactly, you flash the lights 3 times. The windows fog up, and the word "help me" shows up on the fog over the car. Sometimes, you got to wait a few minutes. This actually happened to me once, by the way. Now to our story. We get to said road at around 11:30 p.m., and of course it's patchy fog down the whole road, which puts everyone on edge already. The road is somewhat long with privately owned land at the end of it. Where you sit is kind of on a dirt turnaround kind of thing, with a gate at the other end. The good stuff happens on the other side of the gate, of course. So we split into two groups of three. Three sit by the car and try to get evidence, and then the other three, me included, go past the gate. Past the gate is a dirt path that takes you up to a small bridge, where the body was dumped. We all have flashlights, recorders, and cameras, just regular snap cameras. We get a few feet into the path, and the first thing that happens is my son's flashlight, which says charge for 5 to 6 hours, dies. Yes, I charged it all the way, and even charged it right before we left just in case. It just freaking died. It didn't come back on until I plugged it back up at home. Then the creepiest thing happened to me, and only to me for some reason. I saw a face above, at maybe 8 or 9 feet in a tree. No eyes or mouth, they were just gone. I turn away to make sure my mind isn't playing with me. I look back expecting maybe the moon or something, but there was nothing. So I kept to myself about this, not sure if I was just tripping. We keep going till we get to the bridge. Dead quiet. Nothing. You could barely hear the water underneath the bridge. So I and my friend Jay go onto the bridge to try to get some pictures. I thought he was behind me the whole time. Turns out he never went as far as I did. I feel breath on the back of my neck. I tell Jay to stop messing around. I look behind me and see him at the beginning of the bridge. I have a minor freak out and went back to him. While we were at the top of the bridge, my other friend P went underneath it. We all get scared when he comes hauling ass back up the hill saying he saw a shadow figure in the woods. So, we book it back to the car. While we're running back, we hear a set of footsteps running past us, and all three of us see a huge shadowy figure running through the woods beside us. They darted past us in almost a blur, but slow enough to see them individually. They haul absolute butt through the woods, and thankfully, that's the last we saw of them. We get back to the car and start to leave, only just then figuring out that there was "Help Me" written everywhere. We all hear footsteps outside of the car, but don't see anyone, so we just booked it back to the UDF that's around the corner to kind of somewhat calm down and tell our experiences. No one saw or felt anything like I did. We also think whatever was out there followed us home, because we were all awoken at the same time around 3 in the morning. Our clocks were flashing and the power didn't go out. Sorry for the long story, but I figured you guys would want the whole thing. I hope you guys enjoyed my little nightmare. My mother shared this story with me, so it's not from my perspective. She and her friend, who shall remain nameless, were traveling after work from Great Falls, Montana, for a camping trip at Holland Lake. The sky was darkened more than usual with impending storm clouds. Along the way, they had found themselves inadvertently sandwiched in a 3-semi convoy heading down the highway, doing something like 55. As my mom and her friend passed Lincoln, Montana, a heavy downpour began, severely limiting their already limited field of vision. It was at this point my mom and her friend were surprised when the passenger window completely dropped, in such a way that they were lucky the window didn't break. My mom and her friend looked at the now completely open window. There, they saw a figure that was hovering next to their open window, moving 55 miles per hour along with the vehicle. None of the semis seemed to be reacting to this. My mom described the figure, of which she could only see the head and shoulders, as a man wearing a World War era gas mask or something like that. They immediately pulled over at this bar in Clearwater Junction. They received a free shot each, the bartender commenting that they both looked like they saw a ghost. Fast forward to 1987, my mom comes across a just-released Communion by Whitley Strieber and immediately freaks out. She shows the picture to her friend. The first thing her friend did was scream and they yell at each other, because that is exactly what they saw that day driving. I'm not really sure how to explain this, and I know it wasn't really the scariest story, but thank you for sharing it anyway if you do. I'd like to preface the story by saying that in my youth I was not a good person. People's opinions had a strong effect on me. The neighborhood I grew up in was riddled with crime. As a result, most things surrounding me were criminals. Seeing the smooth cars they drove and the clothes they wore made me believe breaking the law was a cool way to move up in the world. Most of my friends thought the same way. When they got involved in a little bit of villainy, I was right behind them. Not joining in their crimes didn't seem to be a choice. A few times my gut told me their schemes were a bad idea. Their questioning of my manhood put me back in line, though. They knew how to push my button and exploit my low sense of confidence. Growing up without a father can often do that to a man, and it took me a long time to learn how to create and overcome this, but this story isn't about that. Throughout my younger life, I spent a large amount of time in some kind of jail or prison. It took a good 20 years to realize that that path in life was a dead end. Don't get me wrong, I wasn't a violent offender, most of us weren't. My meaning is only to say that that kind of life gets you nowhere, and that was just where I was when I heard of the sickest story I ever heard. One of my many stints in prison in Texas, I was moved from the local county jail to serve the remainder of my 3-year sentence. On one of my many stints at prison in Texas, I was moved from the local county jail to serve the remainder of my 3-year sentence. I had learned over time that when sharing a cell with another man, it was important to be respectful and friendly, but to remember that no one was truly your friend. My new cellie was quiet and heavy-set, and he was in his 40s. When I was moved in, he pointed to the bottom bunk and I put my stuff down. I introduced myself and he just sort of grunted and nodded his head. He appeared to be a quiet guy, and that was fine with me. Being a reader, I hated sharing a cell with a guy that talked constantly. He didn't offer his name and I wasn't gonna push. If he wanted me to know, he'd tell me. The first few days were quiet. We did our own things. Chow and rec. Usual prison stuff. On my third afternoon in, we were locked down after some gang members stabbed another. Expecting the visual, silent treatment from my cellmate, I rolled onto my bunk and cracked open a book. Minding my own business and focusing on my book, I hadn't paid attention to what he was doing. I was shocked out of my own world when by a low, gravelly voice above me, it was my cellie. He began asking me stuff, like what I was in for. The shock of hearing him talk after all this time made me forget momentarily. Oh yeah, sorry, manufacturing meth and stuff, the usual for me. I knew he'd want to see my papers to verify, so I passed them up before he asked. Good to hear, if you were a pedo, I'd have to kill you. This wasn't a surprise to me. The usual attitude toward any guy that came in with any sort of child charges was killed on sight. If I was a child molester, I'd deserve to die. He let out a low grunt in agreement, and I expected to be all he had to say for God knows how long. But he was far from through, though. I've killed a couple of men in my life, but I love killing pedos the most. I was a little surprised by this. A dude at Chow told me my first day there that my cellmate was inside for making meth too. So his talk about killing and talking so freely at the time surprised me. Guys usually avoid talking about that stuff. There was a snitch around every corner. Maybe he was testing me or thought I would be too scared to tell. Regardless of the reason, he didn't hesitate. Being too curious to speak, I just listened as he told me the whole thing. Back in 72, I was hitching across Texas. My daddy had moved with his girlfriend to New Mexico. Since my mama kicked me out once I got expelled from school, my dad's was the only place I had to go. Now, I ran into a dirty old son of a gun every now and then, but not like that last bastard that picked me up. A long-haul trucker had just taken me as far as the New Mexico side of the state line, and I was hoping to get to my daddy soon because I was running out of money. After not seeing anybody for a couple of miles, I managed to get picked up by this old Ford truck. He seemed like a regular type of man, not the kind to be who he turned out to be. He had driven about 10 miles and he turned to me and mentioned that he could take me to the rest of the way to Santa Fe. Me being tired of walking, I was one happy fella to hear that. Then he told me I'd have to blow him. I was only 16 at the time, so I was somewhat confused as to his meaning. That was until he began unzipping his jeans. Then I caught on real quick. I had no intent of doing anything like that, and I told him so. The look on his face made me angrier, like he didn't believe me. I noticed he was pulling the truck to the side of the road, and I thought he was going to let me out. Instead, we stopped, and he turned to me again, insisted I could ride all the way to my daddy's if I just did this one thing. This time, the tone of his voice got more desperate. Well, of course, I was furious by now and told the son of a gun to go to hell. When I turned to open the door to get out, he grabbed me and tried to force my head down onto his, appendage. There was no way I was going to let some man treat me like this. So while I fought him off, I stabbed him with my buck knife, till he just quit fighting. Once I was sure no one had seen me stick him, I got out and pushed him over to the passenger side I'd been on. I took his place behind the wheel and drove about a mile up the gravel road until I saw a big cliff I could push him off of. It took some work, seeing as the old man had a good 50 or so pounds on me, but I managed to get him over the cliff. His body fell around 50 feet, and I saw his head smash against some rocks. Ah, it was awful. If stabbing him didn't get him going, that cliff sure as hell did. I washed myself off in the little creek further down the hill, considered taking the truck the rest of the way to Santa Fe, but I knew the law was looking for if someone reported him missing. So it seemed like a shame leaving that nice little truck out there to rust, but I sure as heck was not going to get caught driving it. The walk back to the highway took a few hours. I managed to make it to my daddy's about a week later, and that's where I stayed until I got up on a gun charge. I'm still not sure to this day if that story was true. Regardless if it was or not, I made sure to watch my cellmate for the remaining of the time we bunked together. When a man does something so cold you can't turn your back on him, some small slight could be blown out of proportion and you could end up dead. A lot of years have passed since I heard that story. My cellie and I never discussed it, and I never repeated it until today. As I said before, I'm not sure if this ever really happened. But somewhere, on a lonely highway, potentially, this guy killed someone. And I hope closure is found one day. In my younger years, before the divorce of my parents, we often spent our summer holidays taking road trips to various tourist spots across America. We, of course, hit all the usual places. The Disneys, the Grand Canyon, even Hawaii once. Hawaii wouldn't exactly qualify as a road trip, but it only seemed right to include it anyway. Spending so much time on the highways and back roads means you're more than likely to have at least one memorable experience, if not more. But today, I will share one in particular so extreme it would prove to be the undoing of our happy family. This specific summer I have in mind, my dad wanted to change the regular routine up and do something a little different. At first, he wouldn't let on what he had in mind. But once each of us had our formed theory, he filled us in with the complete plan. He booked us into a dude ranch in Wyoming. Not yet a teenager, I loved the idea, and my younger brother felt the same. However, when it came to my mom, she was much less enthusiastic, at least at first. She had no idea how to ride a horse or how to do anything related to it, considering she grew up in Chicago. But the moment my dad reminded her that none of us did either and flashed her his charming smile, any misgiving she had disappeared. Dad always knew how to bring my mom over to his way of thinking. She told us that, "Your dad is so charming, and he could sell ice to an Eskimo. Twice." I guess this meant she was unable to hold her ground against a man she found so handsome. This is why their separation was just a few years later. It surprised me so much. This is why their separation just a few years later surprised me so much. We rejoined the story on the road to Wyoming. That morning we had left Phoenix bright and early and had said we would make it to the ranch somewhere around dinner time the next day. The drive itself was normal until we got a flat someplace in the middle of Utah or Colorado. I don't remember which state we were in at the time. My brother and I had been in and out of sleep most of the ride, and when you're 10, every state kinda looks the same, or at least it did to me. I do remember specifically that the time was about an hour before sunset. I just learned the Cub Scouts how to estimate time using the sun in your hands, and I estimated it to be about, hands width. So the moment my dad realized he had a flat, he pulled over onto the rocky shoulder and started to unload the jack and four-way we had in the back. We were on one of those old two-lane highways in the middle of nowhere, and we had plenty of room to get out. I guess the noise at the flat had roused my brother from his slumber, and he was soon becoming his usual annoying self. In an attempt to give me and herself some relief, my mom suggested that he go outside and help my dad change the tire. This suggestion excited him, of course. Being a 7-year-old, he loved doing that kind of stuff, even though he really wasn't any help at all. Since I'd been spared the trouble of my little brother, I was soon falling asleep again. The last thing I remember was the image of him kicking something at the barbed wire fence about 10 feet away from the car. When I awoke again, I was laying face down on the floorboard of the back seat, and my chest and face were hurting a lot. Everything was ringing at first, but soon I began hearing my mom moaning. After I lifted myself from the floor, I saw that she was injured for some reason. There were bloody cuts all over her face, and the windshield was busted into a big spiderweb shape. Once she noticed me, she reached over the seat and asked me if I was okay. My chest was still hurting, but as far as I know, I was fine. I still wasn't sure what had happened at this point. That was until my mom told me to get out of the car and check on my dad. I agreed, but I didn't know why I would need to. When I opened the heavy door, I looked back and saw my dad sprawled out on the gravel-covered shoulder. Other than a little dirt in his clothes and a bloody nose, he looked like he was sleeping, but he wasn't. I jumped over and went over to him. This is when I realized what happened. The back of the station wagon was smashed and moved a good 10 yards. Not far away, but a black Camaro was smashed into one of the fence poles holding the barbed wire, but the door was open and no one was inside. This is when I started taking things a little more serious. I kept shaking my dad, but he wouldn't respond. My greatest fear was beginning to look into a reality. Soon, however, a couple of men ran up to me and said that an ambulance was on the way and they'd help my dad. If I wasn't already overwhelmed, I heard my mom's screams behind me. Turning to look, I saw her holding my brother in her arms wailing. I didn't know then, but he was dead, and no matter what the doctors did, they couldn't change this. The remainder of the day was a blur. The only thing I can recall was the ride in the hospital and my mom sitting with me as we waited to get the news about my brother and dad. Later that evening, they notified us that my brother had passed. This news hit me harder, I think. My mom had known the second she saw him that he was gone, but I couldn't stop the crushing feelings of guilt I had for all the times I'd hit and yelled at him. My dad did end up pulling through. He had a punctured lung and a swelling on his brain, but after a couple of emergency surgeries, he was eventually able to get back to 100% health again. However, when it came to his emotional health, I think the loss of my brother changed him, and a lot of that came from guilt. It wasn't until much later that I found out that he told my brother to go play because he didn't need any help. I don't believe that he was being malicious toward him in any way, but regardless of this, he blamed himself on my brother's death for the rest of his life. My personal belief is that my mom knew what he had done, and she blamed him, or maybe she blamed herself for sending him outside. This was never said out loud as far as I know, but it had to be something like this that would cause a divorce. It seemed after the wreck that every time she looked at me, it made her sad. Maybe I looked too much like my dad and I reminded her too much of his unforgivable sin. I have no clue. This all happened back in 1982 after all. Since they both passed now, I guess all my theories and questions can never be addressed. Maybe that's for the best anyway. Like they say, a wound can never heal if you keep poking at it. I'm not sure if that's really true. I'm probably not the right guy to ask about those things. But from my experience, talking about something painful can sometimes make you feel better. After all, that's what I've been doing here, haven't I? This specific story is a true account of a scary incident I was unwillingly made a part of when I was a young man. It's also the story of how a lifelong friendship can be destroyed because of a stupid decision. This whole story started about 10 years ago when I was just a senior in high school. As a freshman, my best friend and I had made a plan to take a road trip across the country to Vegas, where we would gamble and celebrate our graduation from school. Despite several close calls with my math classes, I still managed to get the credits I needed to graduate with my class. It was something that I must admit I wasn't sure was going to happen. When it came to Glenn, my best friend since I was around 4 years old or so, and the other guy involved in the scheme, there was never any doubt he'd make it through the rest of us. He ended up graduating second in our class after all. Even though the plan had been in the works for 4 years, we had yet to okay the trip with our parents. We also had the logistical problem of neither one of us owning a car we felt could be trusted on a long trip. Then, like a gift from the gods, my parents gave me a brand new convertible Mustang for a graduation present. The day my present surprised me with the car, my dad happened to ask me what I had planned for the summer. Since I had yet to unveil our plan upon our folks, I saw this as the best opportunity to drop it on mine. After I laid out the whole deal to my dad, he stood silently for a moment, with a look of deep concentration on his face, then, after what seemed like an eternity, said, "Well, you two are about to go off on two different colleges and won't get to see each other for at least 4 years. I don't see why you can't have a good 2 weeks to celebrate and blow off some steam. Have a good time, but please be careful." I was so excited. I could barely say thank you, but I pulled it off in the end. When I called Glenn to give him the good news, he told me his mother had already okayed him to go on the trip. This really wasn't much of a shock considering his mom had given him anything he wanted since his dad left him at 5 years. She even gave him $500 as she called a graduation present, but we know that she knew that he didn't have a dime to take on the trip with him, so she probably just gave him the money for that. He was well aware that the moment he told her about the trip, she would give him money, but he let her continue on with her quote-unquote graduation excuse to make her feel better about it. The Monday after the commencement ceremony, we packed up the car and headed out. Although we had 2 full weeks to enjoy ourselves, we wanted to get to Vegas as fast as possible. We had invested in a radar detector, so we were less likely to be pulled over for speeding, and believe me, we were speeding. Averaging around 100 miles per hour ensured us we got across the state in record time, and this was our plan for the entire drive back and forth. We managed to make it to Vegas in less than 7 hours, but we were so tired when we got there we decided to crash out, so we'd be fresh when we hit the casino. After 8 or 9 hours of sleep, we hit the town. I'm not sure how long we managed to stay up for, but at the end of the week, a long binge of girls and gambling, I felt as though I'd been awake for a year. By the end of that week, we'd lost anything we had managed to win 5 times over and we were dead broke. I may have lost every cent I'd saved for the past 4 years, but I'm confident I'll never have more fun in my life than I did that week in Vegas. Unfortunately, Glenn managed to ruin all that fun with one dumb action. An action that would destroy our friendship forever. We had just about enough money left to pay for gas back, so the morning after a 10-hour rest, we loaded up the car and made our way home. I was sure I'd need at least a week just to recuperate from the trip, so I was in a hurry to get back to Albuquerque. Halfway home, I came across a guy hitchhiking. Obviously, if I had been driving, I wouldn't have stopped, but Glenn thought he was going to be funny and pulled over to let the guy in, or so I thought. He pulled over the car despite my many protests. The hitcher began jogging toward the car. When he was about a foot from the car, Glenn slammed on the gas and took off, blasting the rocks into this guy's face. He had done some sorry things to people before, but this was beyond funny. As far as I was concerned, and if it would have ended there, we'd probably still be friends today, but it didn't. Less than a mile down the road, he realized the car was running on fumes, so Glenn pulled into a gas station not far ahead. While he pumped the gas, I went in and paid, and while I was there, picked up some snacks and drinks. On my way out, I happened to notice someone running down the side of the road. He wasn't far away when I realized it was the same hitchhiker Glenn had just sprayed with rocks. He was still around 50 yards away from the parking lot when I pointed him out to Glenn. Apparently not caring if we had an encounter with the guy or not, Glenn continued to watch as he drew closer in the rearview mirror. He finally put the car in drive and began slowly pulling out of the gas station lot. I wasn't sure why he was driving so slow, so I yelled at him to go ahead and stop taunting the guy. He was acting as if he wanted the guy to reach us, so he could continue to mess with him. The hitchhiker could obviously see us. I could hear him yelling in the direction of the car when Glenn had circled the car around the pumps and was pulling from the lot. The hitchhiker was within spitting distance from us. Now I could hear what he was saying, and he was definitely angry. Hearing this only proved to make Glenn laugh, but the look on his face quickly changed to one to fear terror when he noticed the hitchhiker pull a gun from the back of his pants and aim it at us. I only heard, "You sorry mother," before he started firing. The gunshots finally got Glenn to press the gas. We were out of sight of the gas station in a matter of seconds. To say I was mad would be an understatement. Not only had he got my car shot up, but we almost ended up the same way. All just because Glenn thought it would be funny to antagonize a complete stranger. We made it home a few hours after that, and I didn't talk to Glenn the whole remainder of the drive. When I dropped him off at his place, he attempted to make a joke out of the whole experience, but I wasn't laughing. The incident had showed me how cruel he could be, and I didn't want to have anything to do with anyone like that, no matter how long we'd known each other. Once I made it back home and explained to my dad what had happened, he was mad, but he understood why I wanted to deal with the repairs myself and not get Glenn involved, in any aspect or form from that day forward. The repairs were handled, and a few months later I went off to school. Glenn did make a few attempts to patch things up with me, but each time he called, I let it go to voicemail. I never bothered to call him back, and we still haven't spoken all these years later. If there was anything I took away from this part of my life, I learned that people may never tell you the type of person they truly are, but they almost always will show their true face if you pay attention. It probably sounds petty that I would end such a long friendship over something so small, but that incident showed me that even though, after all these years of being friends, he had no respect for me, or others for that matter. If he couldn't say sorry after all the carnage he had created, I couldn't respect him. My hope is that he would learn from this and maybe became a better man. But when it comes to people, one thing I've discovered is that they are rarely going to change. Thanks for listening to these creepy highway horror stories. Man, I tell you what, I drive on the highway pretty much every day where I live, and I've seen some weird stuff there, but luckily haven't experienced anything creepy. If you have a story that you would like to share in a future video, whether it be a creepy highway story or something else, be sure to submit it at swampdweller.net or the email you can find in the description down below. I'd love to share your story, as stories like yours will help keep this channel going. If you enjoyed these stories, please hit that like button as it helps me out a ton. If you're new, why not join us here in the swamp? Subscribe and turn on notifications to never miss a new video, as I upload them almost every single day. And all things natural and supernatural. If you're not aware, you can download your favorite scary stories from the swamp on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, Stitcher Radio, and just about every other major podcasting platform out there. If you guys made it to the very end of this video, I appreciate it so much. Today's code word is Rotten Wood. Comment that down below to let me know that you made it all the way to the end, and so I can see how many of you do make it to the end. I love seeing how creative you guys get with your comments. Once again, thank you so much. Also, let me know how you enjoyed the highway sounds in the background. I think I might add sound effects and stuff like that to the videos again more often. I stopped doing it as a lot of people were complaining in the past. But if you guys like those little ambient sound effects in the background, I'll definitely start doing them more often. See you guys soon with another creepy video.